Webinar with Adam R. Welcome to 3PNR. I'm your host, Adam R. Joining me again is David Marler. David, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Doing good. Doing good. A lot of information out there. You have new information. Before we dive in, let's just remind everyone who you are and your background and how you got on the path of ufology.
Sure. The first recollection I have ever hearing of the term UFO, I was 5 years old way back in 1973, and I'm dating myself and telling the story. My father and my siblings were piling in the car to go down to an area called Piedmont, Missouri. We lived in the St. Louis, Missouri at the time, St. Louis, Missouri area. And they were having all these sightings of UFOs. And one of the first witnesses in that entire series was my dad's best friend growing up back in the 40s and the 50s, because my father grew up in that area. And I remember him saying, you know, if Reggie said he saw a UFO, you can take it to the bank. And just remember all the excitement during this series of sightings down there in Piedmont, Missouri in 1973. And my sister had a close encounter with a UFO outside Kansas City, Missouri, along with her husband late one night in 1977. And then in 1978, north of St. Louis, there in an area called Ellsbury, Missouri, there were UFO sightings. And in this particular case, cattle mutilations that were being investigated by local law enforcement. And that, just like the Piedmont wave before, had garnered a lot of St. Louis media attention. So I was kind of raised in the 70s hearing about UFOs constantly. And then it really wasn't until 1990 I found out about MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and was shocked that there's actually a group of people out there that go out and investigate this. And so I joined right away and was with MUFON for a number of years. And during that time, served as an investigator, state section director, and then ultimately the Illinois state director for several years. And during that time, though, I started collecting a lot of books and materials because I felt like I need to be well-versed. I need to be well-read on the subject if I'm going to go out there and investigate. And what started then as a small collection, you know, my library consisting of a bookcase in my living room, it's just grown over now 32 years, almost 33 years. And it's just been amazing. Involvement in UFO investigations, the people that I've met, lecturing, and then ultimately writing a book on the subject. And so just still involved and still probably have as many questions as I did the first day I entered into this entire field.
Well, the data you compiled is it's on demand. I mean, like Netflix and other shows turn to your information. So you have a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of data collected.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I do it for my own personal benefit first and foremost because I'm curious. I'm curious right. about the subject. I think we're all like that, any of us that are involved in the UFO subject. But over the course of years, though, I've tried, because I do have a lot of this historical material, original materials, case files, news clippings, government records, I decided, you know, I feel almost a sense of responsibility to go out and educate the general public on quote unquote credible UFO material, because, you know, having participated on some of these TV shows, I always tell people for every TV show you see me on, I've probably turned down 6 to 7. Most of these shows are, I think, doing a disservice to the field with the overt sensationalism, with the inaccuracies in the way that they tell the stories, the creative license that they take with special effects. And for those that have heard me lecture, either in person or on YouTube, I really try to stick to the details as it is relayed by the original witnesses. I don't think we should have creative license when it comes to history. We need to be factually accurate in the retelling of these cases.
Yeah, you know, that's my allure to you, is your data driven. And most of the things, most of the articles and some of the things you'd spoken about on the internet and the shows I've seen you on, you stipulate to the facts. And I don't see you ever doing that thing where, you know, like it's in a show and they're like, oh, I wonder what this could be. Like they add this kind of nonsensical ability or excitement that doesn't belong there, you know?
Absolutely. And the things that you don't see, Adam, I've had on a few occasions, not many. I'm pretty judicious about those that I work with in the production field. I have had a few occasions where the producer or, you know, the person that's there assisting the producer would say, well, can you say this? And I'm like, no, I would never say that. And I'm not going to say it on camera. Or if I made a statement, it's like, well, could you phrase it this way? It's like, no, I'm going to phrase it the way I just told you, because that's the most factual way I can state it. And I have a term that I've created, unfortunately, for some of these quote unquote researchers that are prolific, that are on these TV shows on a regular basis. I call them meat puppets.
Yeah.
The producer sticks their hand up their backside, makes their mouth move, and they'll say anything the producer wants because they're getting a paycheck.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, because what happens is people like you and Cheryl Costa and a handful of other people that collect raw data, you get shunned. Yes. And then you get lopped into this category. It's already in the vernacular of people to say conspiracy, right?
Right.
Versus science and data collection.
Absolutely. And Cheryl, you mentioned Cheryl Costa. I absolutely love Cheryl and Linda and the work that they've done looking at the statistics. And in fact, I just wrapped up a lecture tour recently. I did about 8 lectures across the country, including Nova Scotia up in Canada. And I had the ability to see Cheryl and Linda again at the Ozark Mountain UFO conference back in April, and had a wonderful time. I adore them as people, and I adore them as researchers, because exactly that. They have their own personal ideas, as do I, but I'm not out there pontificating on that, because it doesn't matter what I believe unless it's based in fact. And at the end of the day, it's the facts that should speak, not the researchers that have just these idle opinions.
Agreed. And you know, there's this saying that's going around. It's a really tired, worn out saying of woke. And they're directing that towards the U.S. government, military, because of some of the data they released and information they released. I assure you that the government is on some kind of timer, because there's no way they just, I don't think Lou Elizondo would have been able to send the videos and disclose this stuff. If our government wanted that suppressed, it would be suppressed.
Oh, I completely agree, Adam. And one of the big questions that I find is interesting, that most people, some do in the field, but most people aren't asking the right question. They're focused on the minutia of, well, they said this, but they didn't say this. And when they said this, they kind of were cryptic about it. It's like, take a step back, take a deep breath, pause, think, and ask yourself, exactly to your point, Adam, the question is, why, after decades-long denial, after December 2017 with the New York Times article, why now do we have this complete 180-degree shift in official policy regarding UFOs?
Yeah.
And the question is, why now?
I think the answer is kind of simple. I think there's a few parts to that. One, the billionaires are going to space. And you're not going to silence the billionaires for them.
Right.
Yeah. It's a competition. Who's going to do the most? Who's going to go the furthest? Bezos is discussing the idea of having like a cruise around the moon for the wealthy.
Sure.
So eventually you have a large number of people in space, celebrities, regular people, everyone with a camera on board.
Right. So, absolutely. And I think, you know, going back, because obviously there's been so many developments, Adam, since the New York Times article came out. But when you look at the timeline of events in, I believe it was April of 2019, the Navy spokesman came out and stated that they were going to formulate official policy and procedures for naval personnel to report UFOs. And that was kind of the big news story. But in some of the newspaper articles that I saw related to that, there was another statement, and they added, due to the increased frequency of UAP activity in and around sensitive military operations areas. And I think that might be a hint as to why we're seeing this shift. I think that they may be seeing an increasing trend, or that perhaps we're just simply detecting these things now with the high fidelity detection systems we have. But if they see that there's a linear progression and year after year sightings increase, they have to be considering the fact, if this trend continues, it's going to be to the point in the next 5, 6, 8, 10 years where, if this trend continues, it's going to be untenable to try to cover this up. And to use the old Washington, D.C. phrase, I don't think they want the tail wagging the dog. In other words, they want to control the messaging. They want to script the narratives in case that this material suddenly comes out and the fact that it can't be covered up any longer. And added to that, your comment with the civilian space projects going on right now, where more people are going to be going into space, more people are going to be seeing things. Yeah, it's to the point now where I think that they feel they're going to have to start conceding that there is something there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not asking. I think we need to replace the word disclosure. I think that that word, what happens is it becomes a puppet show. And what they, we should do, instead of using for the government in the future with these congressional hearings, which I find to be comical, get that word disclosure, remove it, and fill it in with the word acknowledgement. The public would love acknowledgement, you know?
Yeah, there's a certain amount of baggage tied to disclosure. And unfortunately, and you know, Adam, I take issue with UFO researchers as much as I do skeptics sometimes. Unfortunately, there have been some UFO researchers that have milked the idea of disclosure for years, pontificating and speculating about if and how it's going to happen. And to me, I'd just rather focus on the data that we have rather than going down that rabbit hole. But to your point, it has a lot of baggage. I've already said we've had disclosure with a lowercase d. When the Pentagon report came out, despite the lack of substance, it did acknowledge there is a phenomenon. And I've had conversations recently with local Albuquerque media outlets where I'm based here in New Mexico. And I've stated that. I said, you know, your readers or your audience, if they're still relegating UFOs to tinfoil hats, they're not keeping up with the times, because the government has acknowledged there is a phenomenon, whatever it is.
Yeah. And there's brave souls out there, respected scientists, Avi Loeb type people that are stepping up and they're saying we need programs. You know, it's about time.
And I would also add to that, Adam, and I'm sure you'll agree, the Navy pilots that have come forward, they didn't have to come forward. They chose to.
And that's another problem, too. In the congressional hearing, you see these people, and none of them have any field research background. None of the people asking questions even have a remote idea of what the UAP UFO phenomena is. They're shooting around questions in hope to satisfy the public. People like you. And people like Kathleen Martin and people like Cheryl Costa should be present at these congressional hearings asking the proper questions.
Well, I wasn't going to mention this, but since you went there, I do know a couple individuals that know individuals on Capitol Hill that are working on the subject. And I was told about a month or two ago that there's been a few names that have circulated on Capitol Hill with regard to the history of the subject. And yours is one of those. So. I've been asked by friends and colleagues, if you get called to D.C., would you go? I said, absolutely. I said, someone has to educate him on the history.
Indeed. Someone with data. Someone that's invested
in
time.
And why not? In any other context, Adam, the government does solicit input, does solicit, professional advice in other areas. They tap professionals in given disciplines to weigh in on certain situations. So why should UFOs be any different, or UAPs? And I would argue, I think 2023 may be a pivotal change with regard to that, because you may have seen the National Defense Authorization Act, at least the draft that we have currently, that hopefully Biden will sign into law in the next few weeks, that has provisions for the first time for them to start looking at the history of the subject, going back at least to 1947. And so to me, that is kind of, you know, the foot in the door to begin having this dialogue about the history of the subject matter. And I've been saying for the last few years, it's great that the media is discussing it. It's great that they're talking about these naval pilots, the USS Nimitz incident, the Pentagon UAP program. But it's been carefully crafted to focus on 2004 and forward.
Yeah.
Nobody is. It's almost like there's a glass ceiling as it relates to. No one wants to kind of break that ceiling and go back in history. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One, it's a lot of data to unpack. I think you'll agree. I mean, it's a rich, diverse history of multiple government agencies involved, let alone the civilian data that's out there. In addition, if you start going down the history, and here's another thing that's interesting in recent years, we haven't heard a peep out of the United States Air Force.
No, you're right about that. They weren't even present for congressional hearings.
I think part of that is, Adam, if we start going down the history, and I think they're afraid once people start pulling on that thread, the whole thing's going to unravel. And then people are going to start questioning, for those very few investigative reporters that are still out there, wait a minute, you're now saying the United States government, the United States Navy, that UFOs, UAPs are real. But back in the 50s and 60s, the Air Force was denying any of this. And when you look, Adam, at the conclusions of Project Blue Book, when they shut it down, there were three basic conclusions. All three of those conclusions have basically directly or indirectly been refuted by the Pentagon UAP report that came out last year.
You know, it's in that congressional hearing, you didn't see a single pilot that witnessed. It's really funny to me when you have a congressional hearing packed full of the irony of them asking the question to one of them. Is it true you're a fan of sci-fi? What does that matter?
Oh, yeah.
And then top it off, it's really irrelevant. The pilots should have been present. The military faculty that were there for this, these events, should be present. These are the people that questions should be diverted to, and they should ask. And in retrospect, the people getting the questions asked should be asking the questions of the people on site. They should, but you're not seeing that.
No, you're not seeing it. But if I can add, Adam, I do know that the Senate Intelligence Committee has been interviewing these naval pilots. And one of those individuals that's part of the Senate Intelligence Committee, I don't know details as far as the actual activities, is Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico. And after the first of the year, due to some recent developments, which I'm sure we'll talk about later in the show, I plan on scheduling a meeting with Senator Martin Heinrich to tell him about the historical archives that we have, the historical data that we have, and the fact that if they want access to that material, I'm going to afford them that opportunity, just as I would afford anyone listening to this program.
Yeah. And, you know, frankly speaking, when I hear people in a political role say things like, well, we don't have enough information over in the last couple of decades. I mean, it's nonsense. I mean, again, Cheryl Costa has books with data, raw Absolutely. Data of sightings and locations Absolutely. By time, by date. It's a good reference, and it's like they ignore it.
And it doesn't. When I have people come in here, especially local media recently, when they see the volume of information that I have, and that's just in my research room here, I have a 2-car garage full of additional archival material, and I have a number of collections heading this way within the next 30 days. The collection just keeps growing and growing. They're amazed. I mean, I have on my website, as people may have seen this, I have two rows of file cabinets in a tight little aisle that you can walk down. Those file cabinets are filled with UFO information, both official government documents, civilian UFO reports, scientific papers, hundreds of thousands of news clippings, photographs, slides, microfilm, covering at least 75 years of the mystery. Yeah. So when people say that there's no data or there's not really much in the last few decades, they're really showing their own ignorance with regard to the subject. You really haven't delved into it much. And it was interesting during the House hearings, it was Bray and Moultrie, who were the two intelligence representatives. It was interesting. At one point, I believe it was Moultrie looked to Bray and stated, well, I'll defer that question to Bray. He's been looking at the subject for a number of months now, I believe is what he said. I mean, and in their defense, let's be honest, Adam, let's take a step back from the realm of UFOs. These gentlemen are tasked with the defense of the country. They're Right. looking at Russia. They're looking at North Korea. They're looking at China. They're looking at cyber attacks. They're looking at domestic terrorism. Admittedly, their plate is rather full. And I would argue probably 0.002% of their time is devoted to UFOs or UAPs.
Agreed. And, you know, it is important. I say this a lot of people, like Area 51, there's people like, well, we want to go there and see the truth. Can't do that. We develop things in places like that to protect us, because I assure you, as hard as we're working on making things defend, there are enemies that are working harder to make things to be offensive.
Fact. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes you hear these altruistic statements where people say, well, the government should release all the information they have on the subject. Well, I agree to a degree.
they can't be fully transparent.
They cannot be on any subject, because let's say, for the sake of argument, we have a fundamental understanding maybe of how these UFOs, UAPs function. Maybe we're starting to crack the code on the technology. If you articulate that to the American public on CNN, Fox News, or whatever your media source is, you have just now communicated it to Russia.
Yep.
You've just now communicated it to North Korea, China, and all of our other adversaries.
And they're going to put their best efforts forward to counter that.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's very practical reasons for national defense, and I would never argue against that. But I think, much like everything in D.C. as it relates to this, you have politicians that want transparency of government. You've got the military that's concerned about national security. And we're doing this walk on the tightrope, trying to find a balance between those two.
Yeah. And, you know, the other big part of it, too, is, you know, there's a lot of programs predicated on the history of UFOs. Right. We know this.
Yeah.
Whether they be secret, not secret, I think the biggest problem with them not acknowledging things prior to, let's say, 1990, it paints them in the corner as liars. And I don't think they want to be painted as liars, which is why they change from UFO to UAP, and terminologies are changing in different degrees.
Sure.
Different figureheads are taking the lead. So they don't want to admit to the past because they don't want to be seen as a liar. There's no, I take no issue with them saying, you know, the majority of UFO sightings were projects of our own. It's a great scapegoat to have the UFO phenomenon around so we could test things. And by default,
absolutely.
Yeah, they could blame that.
If you recall, Adam, in the 1990s, the CIA acknowledged that in the 1960s, they were actually fueling and encouraging people to talk about these UFO sightings, because some of the UFO sightings they realized were, in fact, test flights of the SR-71.
Yep, and other stealth programs.
When commercial pilots were saying, we're seeing these silver things, they're flying higher and faster than any aircraft we know. Well, therein lies the answer at the very end that you're aware of.
Right.
And so the CIA used UFOs as a cover. It's like, great. You know, the Soviets, they're not going to think twice. People are reporting UFOs, not describing this ultra high velocity, high altitude aircraft.
Yep. And so there's, again, it goes back to, for the government, if you really want the American people to trust you and not view you in a negative light, the word acknowledgement needs to be brought up more often. They need to acknowledge, yes, these things are here. Like they said it recently, they're here. We don't know what they are, but that's not good enough. It should be, they're here. We're researching this. We're going to develop programs and we'll inform you more as we learn more.
Exactly.
Rather than saying things like, well, we'll discuss this in a closed circuit. Like, come on, you can't do that. It's right. Making people not trust again.
And it is frustrating, despite, again, the official acknowledgement of the subject matter, which I don't think we can, you know, overstate that. I mean, it truly has been a game-changing moment. And people that I have talked to, I don't think would have approached me regarding the UFO subject had it not been for these official agencies and individuals coming forward acknowledging the subject. But that being said, we're still in this weird, awkward state, to your point, Adam. We had the Navy videos that were released shortly after the New York Times article came out, and that was in December 2017. We are now December, almost, you know, on the anniversary of that. We're December 2022. Yep. And so how many years has that been? And do we have one page of official documentation or analysis as it relates to any of those Navy videos?
And
the answer is no.
Yeah, in 5 years' time, since 2017, we have watched the technology of smartphones leapfrog, leaps and bounds, right? We have more data regarding Donald Trump than we do than a subject that this magnitude is kind of, it's a very powerful subject. It's the ultimate subject. It's the question of our mortality. Are we alone?
Absolutely. And again, not one page of official documentation to support those videos.
It's insane.
And so is it any surprise you have the UFO believers, the researchers, the skeptics all still arguing about these videos, that it's an artifact of the camera? Well, no, it's real. No, it's this. No, it's that. Nature abhors a vacuum. In absence of some official documentation, people are going to try to fill the void with their own pet theories, ideas, and thoughts on the matter.
You know what sold me? David Fravor. And the reason I say that is because his take on the subject, the way he speaks about it, wasn't like, oh, it wasn't mysterious. It was jealousy that they had that.
Oh,
yeah, he wanted.
I think Fravor really stands out, and certainly the other Navy pilots, but definitely Fravor. His character, I think his candor in the interviews that he done, as he remarked, as you know, Adam, he's like, I just wanted to fly the thing.
Yeah, you could see in his face he definitely was jealous of the technology, because this is absolutely a guy who, he gets into programs. He wants to be in top. He wants to be the best of the best. Top Gun programs, every jet he could fly, whatever, anything he could do to be at the highest level involved. And when imagine being like a really good race car driver. You have a really fast car and you see another guy drive by you like you're parked. You're instantly jealous. You need to drive that. That's his position, and that's what I appreciate about him.
Yeah, Ryan Graves and others that have come forward that are, you know, working on Capitol Hill, speaking with the Senate Intelligence Committee. As you mentioned, you know, we're not seeing it, but it is encouraging to know that those discussions are going on behind closed doors and that they are being briefed, definitely better than what we saw during the House hearings.
Yeah, I mean, again, if the government is willing to have a greater sense of acknowledgement, more of these people that have witnessed these things, that professional people, I you know, David, I talked to a lot of people off podcast about, mm-hmm. you know, their experiences. I find a lot of lawyers and doctors and police officers, and they don't want their story on the podcast. They want to tell me about it, but I'm absolutely not allowed to use their names. And that's unfortunate, because some of the things I hear are pretty amazing. These are great stories. And so
absolutely,
with a better acknowledgement from the government, you would have these people coming forward, and you could now, it's not, forget how fantastic the story is and how great it would be to hear about it. It's more data to understand what it is we're up against or what we're seeing anyhow.
No, yeah. The stigma that has been associated with this subject for decades, organically, I think it developed. Certainly government really fueled, you know, the ridicule factor, the scorn, the ridicule over the decades. But that has been such a huge filter prohibiting us from accessing more data and having these people step forward and provide their testimony. I've always said, despite all the data that we have, and we have a lot, it's table scraps compared to the stories that have yet to be told that are out there by witnesses.
Like there's a gentleman, I'm begging this guy to get on the show. He's a scientist. He's right now he's in his early 70s. And long time ago, his grandson fascinated with UFOs. And mm-hmm. so this guy, a scientist, goes out and says, I'm going to disprove this phenomenon. And so what he witnessed changed him significantly.
Yeah.
Like it bothered, and so much so he told me, because it actually made me question my religious position and my position as a scientist. It changed everything about me. And I'm like, well, you should come on a podcast. He goes, when I'm done with my work, we'll talk then.
Oh, well, at least you have that open promise. So that's great. Hopefully
you'll eventually. Yeah. Because his story, I was on the phone with him for a solid 30 minutes, and in 10 minutes in, I was dumbfounded, because this guy applied the science he uses. Because the science he does is, I don't want to blow what he is. We'll say he's an observer, a very professional observer, right? And he contracts with the government, or mm-hmm. did anyway. And it just rocked everything about him when he looked into it. And he says there's a lot of scientists out there that they either look the other way, or they're not looking the right way.
Well, I will tell you, Adam, living here in Albuquerque, I think you can appreciate this. I've done local UFO lectures to library school groups, gentlemen's clubs, etc. And on more than three or four occasions over the last 10 years, after concluding those lectures, I would have individuals come up from the audience, you know, asking questions or telling me about their own personal sightings. Like I said, on more than three or four occasions, I have had individuals come up and tell me, I really appreciate your grounded approach towards the subject. I enjoyed your lecture. By the way, I'm a research scientist at Los Alamos. Or they would say, I'm a research scientist at Sandia National Laboratories. And so we have some very smart people here in the greater Albuquerque area that work at these facilities. And I have had them tell me that they have an interest in the subject, and they have stated their colleagues also have an interest in the subject. And ironically enough, I told this same story on a podcast a few weeks ago, and 2 days later, I received an email from yet another individual who stated, I heard what you said on the podcast. I just want to let you know, I live in Albuquerque. I work at Sandia, and I'm one of those people. I have a deep interest in the subject. And he goes, I'm interested in the work that you're doing currently on the subject. And he goes, I'll be retiring next year, and I look forward to helping or supporting any way I can.
That's what I'm saying. If the government would just make, if they would put a better sense of acknowledgement out, people like that come out. And a Absolutely. Lot of these scientists, they're not driven about the mystery of the alien. It's more the technology. Like Bob Lazar, obsessed about the technology.
And Absolutely.
It's ironic that when you see Bob Lazar, and people have mixed feelings about him from his personal life or whatever, listen, in people's personal lives, you're going to, you know, no one's perfect, but whatever you do professionally, you should speak profoundly of who you are. And everything he described in the early 90s is identical to what these pilots are seeing today by description. You know, how it belly first and rotates. The larger triangular ones are more than likely housing the majority of the fleet. You know, so I mean, it's mind boggling that we disregard this data until it hits you in the face. Like the element that Bob was discussing was fiction then. Now it's a practical thing. Oh, yeah. It's on the chart.
Right.
It's bizarre at the most that professional people, period, disregard this because they don't want that stigma. And it circles back to our government. If we acknowledge you'll have a greater collection of data because there's people out here that are professional, are seeing things, or they're investigating it, or they're doing science behind it. You have them come out, and and what ends up happening is we start collaborating as a society.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've always said the more sets of brains we have, the more sets of eyes we have on the data, the better we're going to be as a understanding of the subject, getting mainstream scientists involved, collaborating, working in conjunction with credible UFO investigators that have data to collaborate on this and try to figure out. We all share the same questions. It's just trying to, put our skill sets together and work towards finding answers and finding patterns in the data. And again, shout out to Cheryl and Linda for, you know, putting their statistical data together where you can actually see the frequency in various locations over time of UFO sightings. That's certainly a great step forward, but it's just the beginning.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I mean, right now, whatever's observing us, we know it's benign. It's been around for all the research I've done. It's been around thousands of years observing us, our evolution. Right. We're a channel. I say this a lot. We're probably we are channel Earth. And there's probably many, many Earth-like planets or other planets with life on it. They're observing as well. There's many channels to observe.
Yeah, I know a lot of people take issue when they talk or frame the discussion in the terms of national security or that these things could be a potential threat. But I think we have to go back to the people that are saying it. Their job, the way their brains are wired, they are used to looking and doing threat assessments on everything. So I don't think it's that they're saying they're hostile, but if you have unidentified, let's just say aircraft, Adam, for the moment, unidentified aircraft that clearly perform outside the envelope of our state-of-the-art technology, we don't know where they're coming from. We don't know where they're going. We don't know their motives. They have the ability to fly with impunity through controlled, quote unquote, airspace, commercial and military. And we really don't know what they are. By definition, it should be viewed as and the key word here is potential security threat.
Sure.
Just hypothetically saying if it was Russia, if it was China, we would be framing it that way. But the other aspect to this, and it's a very practical one that I think sometimes people don't realize. Imagine if the Senate Intelligence Committee came forward and they said, you know, we want to investigate UFOs. And certainly these investigations are going on currently with the Director of National Intelligence and other groups. But imagine if they pitched this to the people that had the purse strings. We're really curious about UFOs, and we'd like to have $300 million to, you know, just study it out of curiosity. Versus, we have very alarming information to show that these things are flying near sensitive military operations areas, and our military assessment is this is a potential threat to national security. We would like $300 million. Which pitch do you think is probably going to garner more money?
Yeah, I get it. It's,
idle curiosity is not going to have millions of dollars thrown at it. But if you frame it and I think it was done for practical purposes in that sense, that we frame it as a national security issue, which, again, potentially there's a possibility it could be just because of an advanced technology that we don't understand interacting with us. But so I think there's very practical aspects to why they framed it that way as well.
You can see that exampled in the news, right? Because when you watch the news, they'll speak normally, like how we are right now, until like a negative subject, like, and then also in blah 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 Texas. It's I get what they do. So it gathers the interest when it's a threat, and money will be thrown at it.
Right.
Versus saying, look, we're just interested, so we want to learn what it is. And they're like, well, we don't know if we have the budget for that right now.
Exactly.
It's insanity. You know, I mean, so here's the big part of it. What's here now, like said, benign, we're being studied, but we should put more money to it with the public involved to learn what it is as a whole, because we don't know what might show up here later. And if whatever shows up here later has equivalent technology to this and we don't have a better understanding because we've been so compartmentalized, we're in trouble.
Absolutely. I think the key, and we're seeing this with space exploration right now, I think the key is to get civilian dollars into this. You know, we can wait all day long for federal dollars to flood in to researchers, but I think you may see some breakthroughs with civilians that have the capability, that have almost unlimited funds in some cases versus government allocation of money. You're just going to deal with the bureaucratic red tape.
Here's what I promise. I promise when Bezos gets his people to space and he sends celebrities up again and just two of them spot something, the dollar signs in his head are going to turn into, well, forget the research. This could be my own channel. And you're going to see billionaires now sending things out there to investigate UAPs, UFOs at a large scale, because now it's a competition of entertainment.
Sure.
That's what's going to end up happening. You're not going to see Bezos say, well, for the better of humanity. He doesn't care, right? He's a dollar. He's money. Where, you know, Elon's focus is humanity's future because we can't live on this planet forever. But I promise you, Bezos or anyone from Virgin, they spot something. Cameras are going up. They're the largest financial study of UFO UAPs will be because of that. That'll be the results. Guaranteed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we're hoping to get some funding for the initiative that we're working on right now and trying to preserve and centralize a lot of the history on the subject.
Well, that's when you and Cheryl and Kathleen and you know, Bob Lazar, all these people are going to get phone calls from these billionaires. The minute they have tangible something that they know they could exploit for money, I promise you're getting a call. And it's not going to be to make it fantastic or add some drama to it. They're going to watch your data and your feedback.
Yeah, as you know, Adam, and we say this about these TV productions all the time, why do you have to sensationalize something that is already sensational on the face of it?
It's sad because you see that in every program. I stopped watching ghost shows on TV because I could absolutely tell where the horseshit was. There's a guy who takes his shirt off. He's like, come fight me now. And they wait. They tell you they have this incident right at the beginning. And they wait till the very end before they drop the bomb of, well, we don't know.
It's for
ratings. Yeah. Unfortunately, ratings dictate TV shows. It's changing now. Well, actually, no, it's not. I'm sorry. There's a lot of people on YouTube, and I get caught on this all the time. They get me every time. They say, we now know this. And you click it to find out they don't know shit or it's old information. No. I mean, it's...
I almost liken the UFO subject to religion. You know, if there's a spiritual leader out there telling you they know what God wants for you and your life, run the other way. And just equally so, if you've got UFO people saying, I have all the answers, run the other way.
Yeah, you and I, one thing we in common, I'm driven by curiosity. This is my childhood curiosity at play.
Absolutely.
That's turned into my adult logical curiosity that's probably going to follow me the remainder of my days. I have to know. I will not rest at ease until I know, you know?
Well, and it's interesting too, Adam, seeing the evolution with the government's attitude and acknowledgement of the subject. I know in the early days, people were saying, well, this is going to be the Washington DC two-step. They're going to say that, then they're going to backtrack. They have gone so far out now in acknowledging the subject. I would argue we can never go back to where we were with post Project Blue Book mindset, where there are no UFOs. It's not a threat to national security, you know, blah, 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 blah. The genie is out of the bottle.
Yeah, no doubt.
We're not going to go backwards, but I question, what does the future hold? How will this continue to unravel? How will individuals, and as you mentioned, financiers, come into the fray, and where are we going to take this as far as a serious scientific endeavor?
Like I said, I think the billionaires are going to be the answer, because these guys are, when you have that kind of money and your competition's going to space, you're like, well, I want to go to space too and do it better than that guy. That's unfortunately, when people have that kind of money, that's where the answers come from. And that's when, again, if Jeff Bezos or any other billionaire goes to space and finds something and they don't know enough about it, they're going to have to turn to the experts. And believe me when I say this, they're going to hire the right people to filter out the bullshit from the non-bullshit, which is why I believe you'll be getting a phone call. I believe Cheryl will get a phone call. I really predict that.
I pride myself on having a decent reputation in this field. And I've had friends say, you know, you've navigated the minefield of ufology quite well.
Yeah.
It's I don't cling on to, you know, the most, sensational thing that just happens to be the hot topic at the time. I don't jump down, you know, the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories. I really try to present grounded information, and I share, as in all my lectures, I share my sources so you know exactly where I'm getting the material that I'm telling you about. So there's never a question as far as the provenance of the data. Where is Marler pulling this out of? Well, look at the bottom of all my slides. I always cite my sources. So
yeah,
if you want to fact check me, go right ahead.
The other thing with you too is you evolve. I watch you. I've watched a lot of your studies over the years.
Sure.
As you learn more information and collect more data, you evolve the way you think. And that's the proper way to do it. It's because you're learning more and you're adding, contributing to what you know already.
You follow the data wherever it goes. I, other than the fact that I've always felt there was something objective as it relates to this subject matter. In other words, it wasn't just all hallucinations and misperceptions. Beyond that, I really have no pet theory. People always try to pigeonhole me. Well, do you think it's this? Do you think it's that? Yeah. I'm just simply collecting the data and letting the data take me where it leads. I mean, that's how science is. Not I start with a preconceived idea, and then I try to use confirmation bias to cherry pick the data to support that belief.
So speaking to data, you have new information that you've come across and new studies you're doing, new arguments you're making. Let's speak to that.
Yeah, well, one of the biggest things that I've been working on is collecting more data. And I've had the benefit of having friends and colleagues in this field for decades now. And they truly have the largest historical archives and collections in the country. And these individuals are much older than myself. I'm 54, and some of these gentlemen are in their 70s, pushing 80. And they're trying to decide what's going to happen to their collections. And we've always had a great information exchange over the years. But by virtue of the fact that what I'm dealing with here is a lack of square footage, my wife and I put on a new addition to the house to accommodate our growing collection. We've already surpassed that.
Wow.
And are now spilling out into the garage, where I have rows and rows, floor to ceiling, of file box shelves and file boxes lined up. I have a pallet of material coming from the UK in the next 30 to 60 days. I have, in traveling the country this year, giving my lectures, I've had 10 to 12 other researchers come up saying, I want you to have my collection. I want to send my files to you. One even said, I'm putting you in my will. So when I pass, those files will revert to you. My colleagues are in the same boat. Their homes are literally filled with historical case files, government documents and materials, rare one-of-a-kind collections. And we just decided that, and we've been kicking this idea around theoretically. I decided we needed to take the bull by the horns and really solidify this idea. So we've created a new organization, not dedicated to the investigation of UFOs, because there's been APRO, NICAP, MUFON, the Center for UFO Studies, that have all been focused on that. We've created this new nonprofit organization with the goal of centralizing all of this historical data that's across the country, bringing it together, and creating a nonprofit entity where we can digitize the material, share it, but also continue to collect that material. And we need a building. We need a home for the history. We've all been operating with these home-based archives. We've now decided, and I have agreement on the part of all these individuals, that they want to send their materials to me here in Albuquerque. So when we just get these core collections together, and some of the people I'm referencing, Jan Aldridge, who is one of the senior historians on the subject here in the United States, Barry Greenwood, a dear friend and colleague, one of the largest collectors and archivists of the subject, Mr. Rod Dyke up in Seattle, Washington, has a huge collection. Dr. Mark Rodiger with the Center for UFO Studies, I serve as their archivist. They have their historic NICAP CUFOS case file collection here, the largest collection of historical UFO case files on record. And Mr. Rob Swiatek, who sits on the board of MUFON, the International Board of MUFON. We all have a passion for history. We all have lots of historical material. But just those collections alone that I mentioned, once we have those under one roof, it will definitively be the largest historical collection of historical UFO materials that has ever existed in this country, in addition to the 10 to 12, and I'm sure there will be more, collections that are going to be shipping here over the next 1 to 2 years.
You know, man, that's David, you got a lot in your hands. That's a lot of information. Well,
you mentioned that I've evolved as a researcher. The collection has evolved over time. As you continue to collect more material, the idea of a home-based archive is just untenable, that we now have to think of a freestanding archive building. I referenced it at the UFO Congress where I lectured recently. I said, think of it as the National Archives of Ufology.
I'm going to have to produce like a 3-hour long lecture for you. I'm in my mind picturing all the information you have. It's overwhelming.
It's a lot to unpack. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I've been doing a lot of local media coverage, and the organization is the National UFO Historical Record Center. We have a beautiful logo, beautiful name. It really says it all. And we're trying to create this institution where, as we alluded to earlier, Adam, scientists here in Albuquerque or across the country would not be hesitant to come to our facility, because we don't have little gray aliens waving at you. We don't have flying saucers. All those trappings that you tend to associate with tourist trap locations and things of that nature, we're going to be a much more academic institution, one that's never existed, I would argue, in this country on the subject. And the foundation stones for this will be these large collections, the largest collections in the country of historical materials that are all going to come together under one roof. And also the historians, the individuals who I mentioned, a wealth of material just in their brains, not let alone the physical collections that they have. And so something like this on this scale has never been envisioned before. And I just felt like I was at the right place at the right time. I had the virtue and of respect and friendship with my colleagues. They're trying to find a home to preserve their legacy. And it just seemed logical that, okay, we need to solidify this under a name and bring it together, create a nonprofit organization where we can have people donate money or buildings if necessary here in the Albuquerque area, if there's a business owner that might be interested. And I will tell you, we've had a lot of media coverage. My friend Toby at the Roswell Daily Record wrote a beautiful article in the last couple of weeks. It was picked up by the Associated Press. We have now gotten national and international news coverage as a result of that, and a lot of interest pouring in, people that are historians, people that are interested in creating databases, people that are interested in data management with regard to large data sets and digital files. Lots of people with lots of expertise coming to the table, but we also hope to raise money to again, have a building, to have it staffed. We have a lot of volunteers here in Albuquerque. I've done some recent television news discussing the subject. In fact, as we're sitting here doing the show, I just got an email from one of the local TV stations that just came through about 10 minutes ago. So there's a lot of interest, but we want to have that interest on the part not only of the general public, but business leaders that can help us make this actually become a reality, and politicians. I live here in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Next Wednesday, I have an appointment to meet with the mayor of Rio Rancho to discuss this and see how that could benefit our city and bring in tourism dollars in addition to bringing in researchers that want to look at the data. And I'll be meeting on Friday with a very prominent business leader who has expressed interest in trying to help us develop this. And it'll put Albuquerque, New Mexico on the map. And, you know, I live here, but certainly I would argue if you did a nationwide poll, Adam, and said, which state in the country would you associate more with UFOs? I would argue people, probably because of Roswell, would say New Mexico.
I got to tell you, you're building what I thought should have existed when I was a kid.
Yeah.
As a kid, yeah. I remember thinking there should be a building where all this information's collected, and investigators and people, if the government has questions and if other governments have questions, they have one site they could visit.
Absolutely. And Adam, you're absolutely spot on, because Barry Greenwood, who's been collecting since 1964, said in the 1970s and 80s, he kept envisioning this. And so he's extremely excited. He's on my board of directors for the new organization. I serve as the executive director, but I want to make his dream become a reality, because he's been wanting this for decades longer than I've ever wanted it. And so to your point, it needs to be done. I, in fact, told these individuals when we were starting to really solidify this idea, gentlemen, it's not a matter of should we do this. We have to try to do this, because if we don't do this, the history is going to be lost.
Well, you got to be prepared, David, because when you have this facility and government, let's say the government's like, well, we want to expand on our research in this topic. And there's sure. this facility now. You're going to have like a maybe a conference room or like
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because you're going to have I promise you, military-minded people are not going to sit there and go through data. They're going to want to hear it from a person, and you're going to have to present either like an on-site digital PowerPoint with speech. That's going to be needed. That's important. Not to mention, you should want to cater a little bit to the general public, as far as like maybe a monthly audience comes in to sit down and learn data, future scientists or just researchers that are independent, and they have now a university kind of location to go to.
We're on the exact great minds think alike, Adam. We've actually entertained that, again, depending on the nature of the donations that we financially receive or a building that we might have donated.
Now, there should be a fee for the course, a monthly course.
Absolutely. We have to keep the lights on and the heat on in the building. So, I mean, we'll have to have some way of, you know, continuing to promote and perpetuate the archive. You know, getting the archive is one thing, but then we have to obviously ensure that there's the financial revenue stream to ensure that it continues.
I think it's going to pick up.
I think the timing is right.
Yeah, I would pay to do that in a heartbeat. I would go there and definitely to have one, it's a good trip. Two, it's great information for the interest that's peaked. And three, it's going to be beneficial. I think you're onto something it's going to be bigger than what you think it's going to be.
Well, I think timing is everything, as they say with comedy, right? It's all in the timing. As I mentioned earlier in the show, I think the government starting in 2023 is going to start looking at the history. And I think and thank goodness for the media coverage we've received, with their awareness of our organization and the data sets that we're going to be bringing together under one roof, I would be shocked if they didn't tap us for information in the course of the next year.
It would be a good idea for you to have some detectives, you know, like let's say you want to, here's how this goes. Historically speaking, when a detective approaches someone, it's not just what they did in their act, what led to them to this, what's their past. They dig into every detail. That's the proper way to conduct an investigation. And so it would probably be a good idea for you to have investigators from every realm sit in there, take a lecture and draw their information. And then you could have another database collected upon people's opinions on what.
Well, I completely agree. You and I are totally on the same wavelength with regard to this. I think the problem, and don't take me the wrong way, I don't mean this to be disparaging.
Sure.
I think with the UFO community in general and UFO groups and organizations, they've done a good job with limited funds, volunteer individuals trying to budge the needle as it relates to understanding the subject. But I think for the most part, as a field of study, we've done a good job of preaching to the choir.
Right.
My goal is to have those academics that never thought they would sit down in an archive and look at UFO data, to have those scientists, to have those historians, to have those, as you mentioned, detectives bringing their, you know, investigative acumen to the table to look at the data. I want to have a multifaceted approach to the subject, not just UFO believers, UFO researchers. I want to solicit and bring in these people that have incredible, expertise in these given areas.
Have you sent this information about what it is to Avi Loeb?
I have not. No, I've been busy with the local press releases. And then when it hit the AP wire just trying to field requests, but I would love to send the information to him because, again, we want to make our information available to anyone. And admittedly, Avi and I believe NASA and the AIAA, they're now getting involved in the subject. I think they're going to be looking at more contemporary cases and real-time information. But as I like to say, Adam, that's great. We all can approach this from different angles with different facets as long as we're collaborating. But I would argue, let's not negate the 75 years worth of history that we have gathered, because the history may provide context for what they're being reported today.
Well, sure, because in 75 years, and probably longer than what we actually know, right? Because there's a lot of studies I've read about what we interpreted gods to be in the ancient man.
But exactly.
In the last 75 years, with that kind of data, here's what's happening. These observers also evolve. Their technology evolves. Like, I was just discussing this with Denise Stoner. I was like, abductions are a little different. There's probably, as what she said and what I'm learning more and more, is our devices, like, we all walk around with a cell phone. In this room I'm in right now, there's cameras, there's audio equipment, there's all sorts of recording devices. I have an Alexa, a Google Assistant. And so if they want to observe me, it's effortless, right?
You're low-hanging fruit, as they say, right, Adam?
Exactly. So then with the information you have, I'll get to learn more about them by observing what has changed. Are abductions changing? Are sightings changing? There's no way they're going to use the same exact like the cars we have today. It's based on the same idea. There's four wheels it drives, but the way it looks alters because it's going to meet the needs of newer technology.
Absolutely.
Like the triangles. Absolutely. The triangles have gotten to be more sophisticated in the last few decades because.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So like us, they evolve and their technology evolves. And, you know, people, I hear this a lot. David, people are like, well, why do they always look different? Why are they never the same? How many cars, buses, and trains and planes do we have on this planet? Everything has a purpose. They have different models. Absolutely. Well,
and related to that, during COVID, I reviewed the NICAP case files that I have here. I have, you know, unrestricted access to them. And so I decided during COVID lockdown, I would expand my triangular UFO research and look at this new data set that now I was blessed with having here. And I went through 1947 up to 1977, and I was able to find 102 additional triangular UFO reports. And interestingly enough, the characteristics, the flight dynamics, the physical descriptions, lighting aspects matched the profile that I wrote about in 2013 with the data sets I had available at that time. So there are these trends, these patterns that that seem to carry over decade to decade. And it was really intriguing. And I did my lecture series this year on that, just showing for the first time these historical case files that the general public had never seen before.
Sure. And that's what makes your facility very important. You get to see the historical facts. What has changed? What we can almost, with that information you have, you could almost predict what's going to be, right?
Well, in looking at pattern recognition, you're absolutely right. It's not just looking at the past, but if you see patterns, if you see correlations between various variables, and you see that it's relatively consistent, and you factor in other conditions, to your point, if this is a reoccurring pattern and we know the variables associated with it, then you can almost get into the level of a predictive model for predicting future activity.
It's how we do everything else. Everything else we do is based on that same thing. And
as I like to say, Adam, it's a conventional approach to an unconventional topic.
But it should be conventional because, again, when you have pilots and you have the military acknowledging these things, it's like maybe, you know, in the early 2000s, are UFOs real? We don't know. Now we know. They're real. No question.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
You know, now it's the question mark is who's behind the controls, right?
And that's exactly. Exactly.
I mean, the purpose in itself, people want to argue, well, what would be the purpose? Well, let's be frank here. It's a very entertaining planet, right? It's a great science study in itself, right?
Yeah. It's such a relief to move past that stupid academic question, are UFOs real?
Indeed.
I've been saying for decades, you're asking the wrong question. The question should be, what are UFOs?
Right. What is their technology? Who's behind the controls? What is their motive for being here? What's so interesting about us? And the answer is simple. We're crazy.
And think about it. Think about it, Adam. As the government starts looking at the history, as they hopefully will continue to move forward with their efforts, and again, let's hope there's some modicum of transparency, As NASA, as the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics gets involved in the subject, as we move forward in 2023 with this new organization, the National UFO Historical Records Center, it bodes well for the future. I just see all of this coming together. And I would argue over the next 2 to 3 years, we may be in a better position than we ever have to collaborate and try to gather the data and have some insights into this mystery.
Yeah. You know, David, I speak to law enforcement on the podcast and off. I do a lot of, you know, research. And out of 100% of the people in law enforcement, professionals, I've had U.S. Marshals on, I've had homicide detectives, out of 100% of about, I'd say about 70% are ask about UFOs and or give me a little information off podcast. And one, I'm going to connect you with this guy. He saw a triangular object. And now this is, he is a ATF agent. So his job is basically driving around and there might be people that own a firearm they shouldn't, or he has to check something. Long story short, his partner and himself, where I want to say he said, Nebraska, I think it was Nebraska, saw a big triangular object. And the only reason he based on triangular is because at the angle he saw it, he could see that it had points until it became closer. That it was hard to determine. He said it looked like a Walmart, like a black Walmart flying. That's how thick it was. And then it flashed and he couldn't see it anymore. And he's like, my entire reason for calling this guy is because when I vet people for the show or look into him for law enforcement, I get to speak to him. What do you want to talk about? How long do you want to speak about it? And he's like, well, I really don't have a lot to contribute. My job's fairly boring. I just check people's firearms. He goes, but I do notice on your podcast talking about UFOs, and that's when that came out. And in my mind, I'm like, if we had better acknowledgement from the government, people like this gentleman, a professional, an agent, would step up and say, this is what I saw. I can't tell you what it was, but it was an enormous, it looked like a building in the sky. It was not aerodynamical by any means, you know?
Yeah. I've interviewed a number of police officers over the years. And in fact, I had a real special treat. I was in Ohio back in, I believe it was August, giving a lecture. And there was a gentleman sitting there afterwards. There was a group of us just, you know, socializing afterwards and talking about this and that after the end of a long day of lectures. And the gentleman was describing a triangular UFO sighting he had. I believe it was 1975. And he's describing it, and it sounded eerily familiar. And I'm listening to this gentleman, and I'm literally sitting next to him at this big table. And he's going into all these details. And then at one point he said something about, well, then the guy said, hey, Zach. And I looked at him and I froze. I said, Zach, I said, you're not Zachary Space, are you? And he looked at me. He goes, yeah. I said, you're Zachary Space. And he laughed. He goes, yeah. I said, I researched your case. I found it in the news clippings when I was writing my book back in 2012. I said, I quote you in my book. That came out in 2013. I said, I never thought I would have the opportunity to meet you. And so he was just amazed that I had quoted him, actually incorporated his sighting into my book because it was fairly significant. And here I wrote about this guy. I even lectured and would quote him in my early lectures in the early 2000s. Fast forward to 2022. And here I am in Ohio sitting next to the man, didn't even know who he was. And I finally had the opportunity to meet him.
Wow. Wow. I mean, that lets you know the kind of work you put in
was a special treat. I mean, I was blown away. You could have knocked me over with a feather, Adam. I said, you're Zachary Space. And he goes, yes, I am. And he was very kind. He actually sent me some of the original newspapers that he had to add to my archives here and supplement my case file on his report.
We're going to have to one day do an episode where you just discuss the cases that you, I can only imagine how many cases you've come across.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I could probably even get some of these historic witnesses to go on air with us if that was an opportunity to do. We could even have some of these officers talk about their sightings.
Yeah. Look, Dave, my platform's your platform. You let me know when you need me. Before
it's all important.
It is. And it's beyond important. I can't state that enough. Like, who was it? Someone recently where I live asked me, because if you had to like have a panel of people to go question the U.S. government, who would it be? And I said, David Marler, Cheryl Costa, and probably myself. He's like, why? Because I ask questions like I have a childlike mind, but it's based on a lot of research. You know what I mean? Yeah. And
Well, I was sitting in the chair I'm sitting in now as I'm speaking with you, and I was watching live the House hearings, and I had a perfect question that these guys could have asked. But, it, you know, again, with the exception of Gallagher, who asked some really good questions, Representative Gallagher, I had a perfect question to ask them where they couldn't dodge the question. But obviously, I didn't have the opportunity to ask them at the time.
You know, what would that question be, by the way?
Well, quite simple, because I was sitting there hearing these abysmal question and answer flying back and forth and no substance whatsoever.
Right.
I would have asked Bray and Moultrie, can you please provide for me an example that demonstrates the characteristics that you are receiving in these UAP reports without divulging sources and methods, without mentioning the witnesses by name, and without jeopardizing any classified aspects to the event or your investigation. But can you please paint a picture for the American public, an example of the details that you are receiving in these reports?
I got to tell you, that's the perfect question, David.
Well, because you don't give them any out. They right. can't say, well, we can't divulge it because of sources and methods. Right. I understand that. I don't want you to go there. Well, we can't divulge this because it's classified. I don't care. Tell me what a Navy pilot saw without divulging where they were and when it occurred.
Yeah, simply put, don't tell me the mission. Don't tell me the location. Just give me give me a description of what was witnessed.
Absolutely.
Right.
And you know, put them on the spot. And I don't mean that, again, I don't disparage these men because they're, you know, they are working for the defense of our country. But please provide us something of substance rather than these vagaries that have been thrown around.
Well, did you notice that Gallagher was the only one not speaking in the narrative?
Yeah.
He was the only one. Yeah. You know, and when he did, I'm sure they gave him a little preparation what he could or could not. I think he went outside of that. But when he did ask a tougher question, it was always diverted to, well, we'll speak about that in a closed session.
Right. You know? Right. And again,
that goes back to your question, though.
Yeah, that's exactly. Right. And so, it was frustrating. But again, I don't fault these individuals. I don't want to be too critical of, you know, these gentlemen are doing incredible things, I'm sure, to preserve the integrity of the defense of our country. So I don't mean to attack them, but rather than Moultrie looking to Bray, who had been looking at the UFO subject for a number of months, to your earlier point, Adam, why don't you enlist the aid? And I'll sign non-disclosure agreements, you know, that, you know, okay, you didn't talk to me, but at least I'm going to provide you and educate you with this information with the hope that you will then share it with the American public. But why don't you tap the individuals that haven't been doing it for months, haven't been doing it for years, but have been doing it for decades?
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't know. That just in that question itself, it blows my mind that the people, I feel like the people in that room, granted they have their position, their speciality, they have no background.
So they don't. They don't know UFOs. They don't know UAPs. This is a task that was given to them just in the last year or two. And so I don't expect them to know the history of UFOs. But again, if you don't know, defer to the experts.
Right. And it's exactly why they didn't ask the right questions. They didn't even drive the right points.
And so I'm hoping, as we, like I said, go into 2023 with the new organization, the National UFO Historical Record Center. We now have an entity. We now have a face. We now have this nonprofit organization that really represents the leading historians and archivists in the country, that now it's much easier to communicate with us through that vehicle. And I hope that they will reach out. And before I forget, Adam, do you mind if I throw up my web address for the new organization?
No, in case promote. Do a couple things for me. Promote that, and even the other podcast where you have that episode where you want to talk about the name of the podcast and where they can find it. All of that, David.
Oh, okay. First the website address. It is www.nufohrc, National UFO Historical Record Center, nufohrc.org. That's the organizational website. And I'm trying to think which podcast, because I've done quite a few recently.
No, yeah, I'm sure you've been busy.
Where I had referenced that. I think it was, was this in reference to Sandia and Los Alamos?
Yeah.
I believe that was Micah Hank's podcast.
Yeah, and I'll put that in the description where people could find it.
Yeah,
I'm big enough. I like the idea of promoting others and getting information out there, because at the end of the day, it's information. It's got to get out there.
And also, before I forget, I mentioned earlier, I had the distinction of being able to speak again at the International UFO Congress in the Phoenix, Arizona area a couple months back. And I, at the very end of my lecture, I did a preliminary announcement prior to our press releases that went out on November 18th. And Alejandro Rojas, who helps run that event, sent me a link where it's the very end where I unveiled the new organization. Under our news section on our website, you can actually see that 15-20 minute segment. And my dear friend James Fox, who was in attendance at that event, I asked him if he wouldn't mind getting up and saying a few words, because he told me in private that he couldn't have done the first hour of his documentary Unidentified without the archival material. He spent 2 or 3 days here just sifting through and collecting tons of visual elements, documents, audio recordings. And I think your audience would enjoy hearing James just talk about that creative process when he was here, because it demonstrates the practical aspects of having an archive, because producers like James Fox can't do their documentaries without having access to the historical materials.
Exactly. I mean, I think, David, I think what you're doing is big. I predict it's going to become a de facto location for anything involving the subject eventually.
Well, it seems like it's definitely heading that way again with just the last several months, with people stating, without even knowing, I might add, that we were solidifying this under a name, under a new nonprofit organization. They were already saying, I know you're gathering the history, you have a great archive, I want my material to be part of your archive. In fact, one of the gentlemen that we recently made contact with is up in Washington State. He and his predecessor, who was investigating UFOs, this is an incredible data set. I just can't wait to take a look at this information. Just to give you and your audience an example of some of these collections that are out there, they collected 50 years worth of UFO sighting reports and data using scientific instrumentation and civilian reports from the area, covering 50 years, but specific to the Yakima, Washington area. So just this collection alone, you have longitudinal data over 5 decades, but specific to a fairly small geographic area.
Man, and our government says things like, well, we don't have enough information.
Well, and I'm here to tell you, we're in the process of scanning the NICAP CUFOS case files, and we're up to 1967. We're still doing a lion's share of work. My daughters are even helping me with the process. And we eventually will have all of that scanned. People that think that all the UFO information is out on the internet is laboring under a false impression. I would argue 40 to 50% of the data is out on the internet, but the physical holdings we have, the physical case files that have never been digitized, obviously aren't on the internet. So there is a wealth of data that is not being seen by the general public and obviously not accessible by government officials.
I got to tell you, man. Like, I keep me apprised of what you learn from what you're going through.
Absolutely.
I got it.
We're going to keep in touch. We're going to continue to have this dialogue as things continue to unfold in 2023.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, what you're doing is important. It's everything I've ever wanted for us to have, like a building of a location with historical facts that could lead to the it could give you the patterns to facts to made it become, because we got to learn. We got to know more.
Well, and it's funny, Adam, we have the stuffing. We just need the structure to put the stuffing in. So we have all these materials, but we're working. And like I said, Friday, I'll be meeting with a prominent business leader here in Albuquerque. And he's extremely passionate about what we're doing and has a lot of connections with individuals that are helping fund various projects in Albuquerque and the surrounding area, as well as local and state politicians. So a lot going on. I'm moving into a whole new realm I never thought I would be involved with, dealing with business movers and shakers and politicians. But it has to happen. Again, if we have this insular discussion just amongst UFO people, we're never going to make this vision a reality.
No, you're
and
right.
So we have to enlist business leaders. We have to invest people that are willing to invest in this from a local standpoint. But in doing so, it's going to benefit the country. It's going to benefit the world by having all of this data gathered and centralized. And that's our two pillars: centralization of UFO data in the United States and digitization of that material.
I agree. I got to tell you again, not to reiterate it, but it's going to become important to investigators, scientists, and government officials likewise. I think moving forward, it's going to be one of the most important facilities that come to light.
I feel it's the most important thing that at least I can do as an individual at this point. You know, I've done my lion's share of doing historical research, and I still will, obviously. I've done my lion's share of lecturing all over the country for years, and I still will continue to do that. But this, I feel, goes way beyond any contribution that I've made thus far. If myself and my colleagues as this new organization can bring that building that you and I have envisioned for decades to a reality, and we actually have an institute for UFO history. And even if you're not interested in UFOs, Barry Greenwood and I were discussing this the other day. He said, how can anyone fault us for what we're trying to do? Because at the end of the day, it's a historical archive. Right. You have historical archives dedicated to World War II, historical archives dedicated to the Civil War. You have historical archives dedicated to every chapter and element of our history and our culture. But we don't have the National Archives of Ufology.
Agreed. And what you have historically, because if you consider the information you have, it's multicultural, it's multi-topic, it's multi-historical. I mean, the information isn't derived from one location on the planet, right? This comes from everywhere. It's information and data collected from everywhere, from all sources.
And having that data under one roof, and again, Barry and I and my colleagues have even discussed this, we've shared information with each other. But if you had all that in one room, let's envision a small warehouse, for example, with all of this data there. In going through Barry's material or Rod's material or Dr. Mark Rodiger's material, I might stumble across something saying, you have a case describing this type of UFO that did this? I have an exact similar case,
right?
But from this data set. Imagine all these puzzle pieces being brought together. It's exciting from a research standpoint to have that much data under one roof at your disposal where you can start cross-referencing. And I've done that here in just acquiring the NICAP case files and my Project Blue Book material that I've acquired, part of Hynix files. I have found correlations with other information that I was already putting together. And then I found corroborative testimony and correlations with other cases around the same time in the same geographic area. And so imagine that 100-fold or 200-fold magnified.
Well, yeah.
What might we begin to understand regarding the subject matter?
I mean, consider this, the Tic Tac in itself, the government, you don't hear them ever say things like, well, we've seen this before. They just, it's new to them. However, right. When you look at the Tic Tac itself, it's been seen through time, a long time.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, we use the term Tic Tac, but I would argue if you go through the NICAP case files, you'll find some reports that describe essentially the same object. But in the 1950s, 60s, Adam, they would have probably said, you know, it was like a propane tank.
Right. Or cigar shape.
Cigar shape.
Right.
Absolutely.
And bear in mind, because now you have your facility where there's references that can be made for the government. They could learn that these things are evolving. It looked like a cigar then, but now it's more like a Tic Tac. This is a newer model, different color.
Well, and the thing that's great about it is I have many people that contact me and they'll generously provide their triangular UFO reports or other UFO reports to me. And in some cases, they may say, you know, I saw this triangle back in 1965 when I was in college. And that's great. That's interesting. I take the information down. It's something altogether different, though, Adam, when you are going through these historical case files and you find a contemporaneous eyewitness report documented and dated from 1965.
Right.
It's not that I question witnesses reflecting back on reports decades ago. But when you find a document dated 1965 describing a triangular UFO that matches reports today, to me, that's much more compelling.
Way more. And it's a good reference, too. Again, the government is notorious for saying, well, before we could call this what it is, we need reference points. We need some historical fact to it. And that's what you're developing.
And that's it. We have the original documents, the original case files. Some going back. In fact, one I have sitting here I was reviewing right before we went on air. This is from Dr. Hynix's Project Blue Book files. These are original government documents, not photostats or photocopies. This is actually signed by the district commander in the United States Air Force. This was a case from Lexington, Kentucky, September 26th. Hold on to your hat. 1949.
Wow.
And I have the original documents right here, the report on the investigation by the Air Force. And it's interesting. Under the subject or character line, it says Special Inquiry Unconventional Aircraft is the title that they ascribe to this one.
That's incredible, man. Like, we're going to have to, I'm right now, I'm like giddy. I'm excited for what you're going to do, right? This is a perfect reference thing. You know, David, I'll give you one thing before we close out.
Sure.
A science-minded person made me think of this, and I just spoke about it with Denise, too. I asked him, like, well, if there's a quote-unquote mothership that's nearby or some sort of station, you know, why can't we see it with our technology and et cetera? He goes, mm-hmm. He said, you're not thinking right. You're not looking at it logically. So if we, as people, he's like, let me ask you, Adam. He says, if you want to build a space station, what's going to be up there that's going to last the test of time? Because our space station didn't do it. It's vulnerable.
Sure.
You find a large asteroid, you hollow it out, and then you have a perfect shield from radiation and debris, space debris. And then it made me think, how many of these things are just outside Mars? We have a belt, asteroid belt, huge asteroids. Very easily, there's some out there that are the size of a city.
Well, and you make me think of Avi Loeb with Oumuamua.
And that's exactly where I drew to. That's exactly the reference.
you make my mind go right to that. I mean, I think he's onto something. And I think it lends to what your friend was telling you, that we have to suspend our preconceptions, right, and take a step back and think maybe on a wider scale of how would we do this if we were going to do this. And we always default to conventional wisdom, right? Because right. That's just natural. Well, you know, this is how we have done it traditionally, but maybe we need to think on a whole new level in some respects.
Yeah, because financially speaking and resources to go build a super large we'll call it spaceship in mm-hmm. space, because we can't build it on the ground and launch it to space. That's not going to happen.
Right.
It's too big.
Right.
So to build something to hold like a city of people in space, it's impractical. Rather, though, you could find a large asteroid, city-sized, hollow it out, have 30-foot of rock on the exterior to protect you from, you know, radiation, space debris, and you could actually we now know. We know to a certainty we could adjust the trajectory of asteroids. We've mm-hmm. done it, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. I mean, the logistics, like you said, you eliminate all the logistics of escape velocity from the planet, the logistics of having to bring all this raw material into space, utilize what's already there.
Right. And then you have plenty of material that's resources right inside that asteroid, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot, David, a lot out there. Anyway, David, we had a good conversation. For those of you listening right now, I'm going to say good day, good evening, good night, whatever it is for you. And I'm going to talk to David in post.